his name is really on most of the foundations. If you hear someone say non-commutative geometry with no other ordinance, usually that means something different. Often that means a different kind of theory, which is associated with the name Valancon. And that's more of a kind of non-commutative differential geometry, whereas what I'm going to discuss today is more of an algebraic geometry. Okay. All right, so that's the introduction. But the basic idea is we're going to generalize commutative projective geometry, using that as a model. So first, I just want to review a little bit about commutative projective geometry. Some of this was done in Alan's talk, but I'll just review it anyway. Okay, so
that was weeks ago.
I said I'm going to do it. Okay, so throughout K is going to be a field, and you can think of it as being C, but it doesn't matter, or any algebraically closed field. Okay, so whenever I say ring, I always mean K-algebra, but I won't always be exact about that. Okay, so the idea is there are nice correspondences between rings and geometry. So let me just describe a few of those. So on the ring side, you can start with the commutative polynomial ring in n plus 1 variables over that field. And what that corresponds to on this side is projective n space. So let me recall the definition of that. It's all n tuples, or n plus 1 tuples, of things in the field, removing the origin, the zero vector, and then modded out by scalar multiplication of vectors. Okay, so another way of thinking about this is it's all rays through the origin in this k to the n plus 1 space. Okay, so what you can do with this is if you have some polynomial on this side, so if you have some f in this polynomial ring, which is homogeneous, okay, so that just means it's a sum of terms which all have the same degree in the x size, total degree in the x size. Then on this side, you can define some subset of that, d of f, and what that's going to be is just all points in the projective space where f vanishes. Okay, so given any polynomial, you can plug in any n plus 1 tuple. You're just taking the points where that vanishes. And there's something to check, which is that this notion of vanishing kind of factors through the scalar multiplication. Okay, so that's something you need to check, but it's true. And so the notion of vanishing at a point in projective space makes sense. Okay. So then you might have some homogeneous ideal, I, in the polynomial ring. So that just means it's an ideal which is generated by homogeneous elements, not necessarily all of the same degree. And on this side, you get some subset of projective space V of I, where you just take all the points that vanish at everything in I. So P in the projective space, where f of p is 0 for all f in the ideal. Okay, so these things, v of I, are called subschemes of Pn. Now, if you like the language of varieties, feel free to think of everything as varieties. But if I tried to do that, I'd forget and say scheme sometime. I'll use the word scheme, but you don't need to understand really what that means. Okay, and finally, what happens if we take a factor ring? Let's call this polynomial S. Okay, so if we take a factor ring of S mod one of these homogeneous ideals, then what that corresponds to over here is you can take what's called proj of that factor ring. And that's just this set V of I as a set.
Your F of P equals 0 for all F and I, but you mean for all homogeneous F and I?
I don't think that matters. Well, okay.
Yeah, because you can multiply and make, you have lots of non-homogeneous things.
Thank you. Okay, so what is proj of a factor ring of the polynomial ring? It's just as a set, it's just this B of I. So it's some subset of projective space. And plus additional structure, which makes it a scheme. And that's what I'm not going to really worry about. Point is, you can just think of it as this set. Okay, so the point of all of this is there's a nice correspondence between ring theoretic things, factor rings of the polynomial ring, and geometry on this side, subschemes of projective space. And this is the sort of story we'd like to generalize, except we don't want to assume our rings are commutative. Okay. And there are lots of other correspondences that, I mean, this basically just scratches the surface in general. Anything you can describe on the geometry side should have an analog on the ring side and vice versa. I guess another thing I should mention is I'm pointedly avoiding doing anything with projective space by gluing affine things. Okay, so this whole theory sort of wants to consider projective varieties as corresponding to factor rings by homogeneous ideals and forget about affine pieces and gluing. Okay. So I want to do something, have some geometric objects that correspond to non-commutative rings, but not any non-commutative ring. So next thing I want to tell you is which rings am I interested in. Well, what we want to do is do the same sort of thing. We want to start with some basic ring, consider factor rings of it. And so instead of this ring, which is the free commutative algebra in these indeterminates, I take a free algebra. Okay, so let me describe how that goes. So now what if I want to do things non-commutatively? Okay, so two, which non-commutative rings? Okay. So now instead, I'm not going to take a polynomial ring, I'm going to take a free algebra. So these kind of brackets, so this is all, so let's say a k basis of this is all words in the xi. Okay, so you can't commute the xi's past each other, so I don't know, x1 times x2 multiplied by x3, x2 is just that x1, x2, x3, x2. Okay, that's how you do multiplication in that ring. And I'm not going to really have anything like this. And I don't have this. Okay, and forget about this for a moment. Okay, but this is the sort of thing I'm going to want to look at. So I'm going to want to take factor rings of F, where I is homogeneous, and that can be defined the same way. I will just be an ideal that's generated by some set of non-commutative polynomials that all have the same total degree. Right, each one is homogeneous, a sum of things of the same total degree. Okay, and hopefully I'll get a chance to say a little bit about what proj becomes here, but I don't have that now. Okay, so these are the kind of rings I'm going to study. But this is a huge class of rings. So to get any sort of results, we're going to have to put some more restrictions. So I'll talk about what kinds of restrictions we put on during the talk. I'm not going to put blanket restrictions down now. For now, I'm just going to be taking any R, which is a factor ring of the free algebra by homogeneous ideal. Okay, so let me just notice that this situation includes the other situation, the commutative situation, because if you take the free algebra, the polynomial algebra is just a factor of it. You just factor out the ideal generated by xi, xj minus xj, xi for all distinct I and j. So okay, so this means ideal generated by.
Should we therefore think of ordinary projective space as a commutative subvariety of non-commutative projective space?
You would if I was ever going to associate a geometric object to F, but I'm not going to. Okay. So there's going to be a restricted class of these R's for which I even try to do geometry. Okay. So commutative polynomial ring is just factoring of the free algebra. And another thing you can do is you can get interesting non-commutative rings by twisting that. And I want to leave that over here as an example. So another thing you can do is take relations that are like that, but deform them a little bit. So you can take a ring like this except now the relations are xi, xj minus is minus some pijs, xi, xj. Those are all zero. Where these pijs are just some scalars, which are non-zero. OK, so we'll call this a skew polynomial, right? And these are very nice rings. I mean, you can show, you can understand the dimension of each graded piece of this ring. It's the same for a polynomial ring, for example. But they're not commutative in general, unless you're silly and you take all the p's to be one.
Does it need any sort of cocycle condition on the p's?
Well, conditions on the p's will affect the geometry of the ring R, and that's something that I'll talk about. But for any p's that are non-zero, this is a fairly nice ring. Okay, so the way you think about that relation is it just means when you move an xi past an xj, those you commute in the sense that you gain a scale. So it's also, I mean, you could do calculations in these rings, for example, do Grosvenor basis techniques. Okay, so the idea of trying to do geometry with these factorings of the free algebra is you want to use commutative geometry as a model, but you have to pick the right description of the commutative properties. You want to describe the commutative properties in a ring theoretic way, which generalizes to some non-commutative thing that's interesting. So there are lots of things you can try to do, and some of them just don't work, or they don't give interesting results. So there's a lot of guesswork in this. But for the rest of the talk, I'm going to describe two or three different properties that you can generalize from the commutative setting to the non-commutative one. OK, and the big one I'm going to start with is the notion of a point. How do you talk about a point? But instead, I'm going to talk about a point model. OK. So first, let me go back to the commutative example. So consider a polynomial ring in three variables. So it corresponds to P2. And take some point. I'm just going to pick a random point in there. OK. So what you could do is you can look at the ideal of the polynomial ring corresponding to this point. So it's all homogeneous things in here, generated by those homogeneous things, which vanish at P. OK, so the point is you can really just, it's really easy to say what's in here. OK, so what you can do is look degree by degree and see what's in there. So a subscript like this is going to mean looking at homogeneous things of that degree. So if I look at homogeneous things of degree 0, well, there's nothing there except the base field k. Nothing in k vanishes at that point. So there's nothing in there. But in degree 1, we can easily find things, and we can find a k basis of it easily enough. So we can take something like 2x0 minus x1. So when I plug in 1, 2, 1, I get 2 minus 2 is 0. We can also do something like x1 minus 2x2. OK, and it's easy to see those are k bases for this space of degree 1 things vanishing at p. So there are two of them in the basis. And you can continue this game and easily see what's in here. So this is this has a basis of 5 elements. So what I want to notice is if instead you look at the dimension of, let's call this S, each homogeneous piece of S, you get the numbers 1, 3, 6. And in every case, we're getting 1 less in a basis for the I as we are in a basis for the S. OK, so there are lots of ways of proving that this always happens, but I just wanted to see this in a particular example. So what happens is that the dimension of the nth piece of I is just 1 less in dimension of the nth piece of f. Okay? And this happens in general. Not just, first of all, you can take any point in projective space. And second of all, instead of starting with S, you can start with any factoring of S and look at points that are in V of I if you're taking the factoring by R. And you get the same sort of thing happen. So let me just say this. So if we have some factoring polynomial, lots of I, and we define now J inside that R to be, and we pick some P in V of I, which is in the projective space. So if we pick J to be all things in R which vanish at P, okay, then J is sitting inside R where the nth grid of P's has dimension one less than the nth grid of P's of R. Okay, so the idea is if you take the ideal corresponding to a point, it's just an ideal that has this property. You can tell if it's one of those ideals basically just by what the dimension of each grid of P's is. Okay, so this is not the way you would usually talk about ideals corresponding to points. You would talk about ideals which are maximal ideals with respect to not containing the irrelevant ideal. But I don't want to do that because that's not the thing that generalizes nicely. I want to do this. Because now what I can do is now let R be non-commutative. So equal to some F mod an I, free algebra mod a homogeneous ideal. Then what we can define is a point module for R. And what it is it's some factor of R, R mod J, where J is a right ideal. I don't want to take an ideal. Now I want to just consider right ideals. The problem is a general ring like this might not have very many ideals, but it has a lot of right ideals. And where we have this property that the nth grid piece of J has dimension one less than the nth grid piece of R. Okay, dimension in order to base. Okay, so that's it. And it turns out that for a lot of interesting R's, there are lots of point modules, and you can say a lot about them, and they help you study the ring. Okay, so that's why one would want to do this. So here's the fact that makes this especially interesting. So for many, and I'm not going to define many, rings R, the point modules for R, here's where I'm going to use some sort of inexact language, form a nice parameter space.
Is the intersection of all those J's trivial?
It might or might not be. That's an interesting question, but sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Okay, so as I've defined this, I mean, you have these point modules, and you can think about the set of point modules. But it turns out there are ways of not just thinking about it as a set, but really ascribing a geometric structure to it. And that's, I mean, beyond the scope of the talk to describe how you do that. But for lots of R's, not only is there a nice geometric structure on this set of point modules, but you can calculate it. And in general, not in general, but in special cases, that structure is actually the structure of a projective scheme. Again. Okay, so
maybe this is what you want to say, but is there some finite n where if you know Jn, then you know J?
That's how you show it's a nice space, yes. For certain rings R, that's true. Okay, so when this happens, when it's nice, this is called the point scheme X of R. Okay, and I'm going to tell you when it's nice a little later. But let me just say here, so you could try to do this with these rings R, K calculate all the point modules. Actually, to calculate them, you can do it using the relations, which is an algorithm. And you find what the point scheme is. It's always nice in that sense. But what happens depends on these PIJs. So there are actually two cases. So one case is if you have P01 times P12 equals P02. So now I just want to do, I only want to do three variables. Okay. The same relation. Okay, so you only have three coefficients. And if you happen to have this relation, then the point scheme, PS of R, is actually isomorphic to projective 2 space itself. But otherwise, you get something smaller, which is the union of the coordinate axes in P2. So what that is it's three lines, so three projective lines.
What is the point scheme again?
Okay, so what you do, you take the ring, you construct every point module you can in this way, and there's a natural way of putting a geometry on that set of point modules, which in nice cases is actually a projective scheme. Okay, so I'm not describing the way you do it. There's sort of some sort of algorithm for putting the geometry on that set of point modules.
But what do you mean precisely by putting the geometry on? You mean putting a topology and the structure of locally ring space?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the point is you can construct all this set of point modules. You can construct it explicitly as a subset of projective space in a way. But I just can't do that here.
So it's the set of J's which have this property, is that?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter. You can either think of parameterizing the modules or the J's. But you might as well think about the J's, sure.
Why can you say maximal ideal?
Because these J's are right ideals. I don't want to take ideals. I want to take right ideals. That's important. Because there can be very few ideals compared to right ideals.
Are they maximal right ideals?
In some sense, but that's not the good thing to do, because you can have maximal right ideals that don't have this property of their dimensions. I think that's the problem. That's not true in the commutative case. In the commutative case, the two things are equivalent, but that's one of the... So this is the whole idea is you have to find the right thing to generalize. Okay.
What do you focus on R mod J rather than J?
Okay, well, this is just notation. I mean,
but is there a good reason later
this on? This thing, R mod J, is called the point module.
Okay.
It's a right module over the ring R.
But it's better to think of it as the set of modules rather than the set of ideals for some reason later on?
No, actually, there's not a lot of difference between those point of views.
Okay.
So this question of whether the J's intersect trivially or not, is that the case one, case two?
Yes, exactly. So in case one, is the case where all the intersection of all the possible J's is zero. But in this case, the intersection of all the possible J's is some non-zero ideal. It's actually the ideal generated by x0 times x1 times x2. Okay. Okay, so those are two kinds of things that can happen. Another example, which I won't write down, there's a ring called this Glanon algebra of dimension 3. And again, you can write it down as a presentation. It's generated by three variables, and now there are three quadratic relations. And in that case, what you get for the point scheme is an elliptic curve. And actually, the group structure on the elliptic curve tells you a lot about the original ring. I mean, this is... there are deep connections between the properties of that scheme and the properties of the ring. Okay. But let me just mention that.
Could you write down the name at least, since you're not writing down the details?
Yeah, okay, so another example. This Glanon algebra. Sklyanin, sorry, my handwriting is not so great. And then, since you asked, I'll just write down what it is. So three variables. And the relations look like this. So the relations are very symmetric. And you get basically all of these relations by taking one of them and permuting the x odds. Okay, so the ideal generated by those three things, and that ABC be kind of generic. So we need some conditions on them. And then the point scheme of that thing is an elliptic curve E, which is smooth. Again, if these are generic. Okay, so this is one where Grosvenor basis techniques actually are very difficult to use. So this idea of studying the point scheme, using that to gain information about the ring, is really the way that the properties of that ring are understood.
And how does the elliptic curve depend on the parameters?
You can write down a formula, actually. You can write down the cubic equation in terms of, with coefficients in terms of these ABCs. But I don't know that off the top of my head. Okay. And the last thing, this is sort of a non-example. There are some rings R. Again, factor rings of F. For which, well, let me say PS of R does not exist as a projective scheme. So there are rings for which this whole story doesn't work out so nicely.
Does it exist as a scheme?
No. No. It's some direct number of schemes.
Does not exist.
Thank you. Does not.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, but there is a theorem that says when this point scheme is nice, so this is by Mike Garten and James Zhang. So here's where if you start putting conditions on the rings, things become nicer. So if R satisfies something called strong Noetherianness, so let's say R is strongly Noetherian. Okay, and what does that mean? It means that when you change the base field to some bigger commutative ring, it's still Noetherian. You have to worry about that for non-commutative rings. Okay, this has to happen for all Noetherian C, commutative C. Then this point scheme of R is a projective scheme. Okay, so that's a very strong existence result. As long as you understand these strongly Noetherian rings. And I should define Noetherian. So I did this kind of backwards, saying strongly Noetherian first. But just recall, so some ring A is Noetherian if all left and right ideals of A are finally generated. So finally generated as modules over A. Okay.
Is it important to ask that dim Rn be eventually polynomial in N?
It's not clear, because it's not clear that a strongly Noetherian ring has to have a polynomial Hilbert function. But you certainly don't need to assume that in this theory.
What do you mean by not clear? It either is.
No one knows any examples that aren't.
Okay.
Well, let me be careful. Yeah, I think that's true. No one knows any examples of ours which are strongly Noetherian and which don't have polynomial, or maybe periodically polynomial Hilbert function.
Is it a conjecture then?
Sure.
Okay, cool.
I think so. But there could easily be some weird example out there, just no one has thought of.
So you don't conjecture it?
I don't conjecture it personally. No, I like to make conjectures that I already know how to prove half of or something.
Yeah.
Okay. So So there's this large class of rings, strong and inferior.
Okay, so those were strong and inferior. That's in theory.
Right there.
This is in the theory, and I had already defined strong and inferior in terms of it. It means that even when you extend the base field to some bigger commutative ring, it's still inferior. Okay, so this, again, this is something a commutative algebra would never worry about, but for a non-commutative ring, it's something you have to worry about. Okay. So, someone tell me how I'm doing on time. I neglected to bring a watch.
1:33.
Thank you.
Here. So you have about 20 minutes.
Okay. So let me just quickly talk about another thing you can try to generalize.
What about the clumpers of the theorem?
Not clear.
Do you conjecture it? Or?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
You'd have to.
It's a stunt.
So this theorem is actually, I mean, what Artin and James saying proved is something much stronger, which is not just for this point scheme, but you can take any possible Hilbert function and graded modules with that Hilbert function, and those are parameterized by a projective scheme. Okay, so it might be true that if all of those schemes are projective, then you have a strong theory. But certainly, I wouldn't say that just knowing about the point scheme is enough. Okay. So here's another thing I want to do, which is generalize the idea of a function field. So again, let me call this a function ring. So let me just look at the commutative case again briefly. So let's consider some factor of a polynomial ring again. And let it be a domain, so I'm modding up by a prime ideal. So in this ring, the product of non-zero elements is not zero. Again, I is homogeneous. Then proj of this ring is some variety. It's some subscheme of projective space, but it's also called variety in this case. And what we can define is the field of rational functions on X. Let's call it L. So let me just say what that is. There's a notion of a rational function from X to K, which just means a function from the points of X to K, which is defined, it's defined as an open set of X, and is defined coordinate-wise by polynomials. So it's basically just polynomial functions defining some open set of X to the base field, L, and that can be described in the following way. Okay, so this is the geometric definition of a function field, and what I want to do, because I want to generalize it to the non-commutative place, so I want it to be a ring theoretic thing. So I just want to see how I can find this thing, ring theoretically. So it can be described in this following way. What we can do is invert all homogeneous elements of R. So for each homogeneous element of R, you would join a formal inverse. So this is called localization. But we just do the homogeneous elements. Call that Q of R, that's some new ring. And what it looks like is basically just polynomials over that field, L. Except you have to also do Laurent polynomials. Okay, so that's what you get afterwards. So basically, the field of rational functions can be recovered by taking this graded ring of fractions, invert all homogeneous elements, and then looking at what's sitting there. Okay, so now this is something I can do with a non-commutative ring. Okay, so now let R be one of these homogeneous factor rings of the free algebra. And again, now we need something. I can't always invert all the homogeneous elements, but I can if R is in theory. So now I want to assume that I don't have any old factoring of F, I'll make sure I have an Ethereum one. Then I can do this. Then we can invert all non-zero homogeneous elements. And what you get looks kind of like that. You'll have some D, and you're adding some variable T, some indeterminate T, and it's inverse. But now there's some extra piece of data, sigma. So again, I'll call this quotient ring of R. So let me say what that is. Where D is a division ring now, so not necessarily a field. It's some non-commutative division ring. And sigma is some ring automorphism of D. And multiplication in this ring is defined using sigma. So here's how you do it. If you take some A times T to the M, and you want to multiply it by B T to the N, you basically move the B past the T to the M at the expense of applying the same power of sigma to B. Okay, so that tells you how you multiply homogeneous elements, and then you can multiply anything.
Does your ring have no zero divisor?
Ah, yes, thank you. So I assume it's in the theory and the domain, so no zero divisors. Now, of course, I need that. Sorry. You can do something similar in more general cases, but you won't get a division ring for D. So thinking about what happened in the commutative case, I'm going to just call D the function ring. There's no scheme that it's ring of functions of, but it's playing the same sort of role that the ring of function plays for a commutative ring, commutative scheme. Okay, so that terminology is less standard, by the way. That's something I call it. Okay. So let's just say what you get for that, say in these examples. So if you have this ring where the relations say the variables speak to you, again, you have two cases, and each of those P is different. So in the first case, what you get for D is rational function field in two variables, some variables U and V. And here, you don't get that. You get something non-commutative. I'm just going to write K, Q, U, of V. So it's some division ring where U and V themselves skew to me by some Q, which depends on the P's. I'm not going to say that. Okay, so in this case, you actually get a commutative field for this D. And in the second case, you don't. It's some skew field. So there's some, my intuition is the more commutative this D is, the more points you have. I mean, that's something that happens in those cases. And I don't know a completely general theorem along those lines, but the one theorem I'm going to state at the end of the talk is kind of an example of that. Okay? So finally, I just want to mention one of the more important things you can do, which is you really can define an analog of proj of a graded ring or of one of these factorings of that. But this is the most technical thing, so I'm not going to give all the details, but I just want to put it out there because it's very important. So let me say proj. So let R be one of these factorings of F, and let's assume niceness, so R is in theory at least. So what you can do is start working categorically. So I'm going to define something called QGR of R in the following way. I take all graded right modules. Now here's, I'm not going to define graded. all graded right modules over R, let's say finitely generated. And that's some category. But I'm not going to take that category, I'm going to take a quotient category. So you mod out by some equivalence relation that says two modules are equivalent. Let's say two modules M and N are equivalent. If you take tails of them, some tails are isomorphic. So if you take all things in M that have degree, if you chop off everything in M from degrees 1 through M minus 1, the same for N, and those two things are isomorphic modules, you say they're equivalent. Okay, so what happens, this is some formal construction called the quotient category. And its effect is basically to make any two modules that have this property the same or isomorphic in the factory. So the reason you would do this, so what you can do is this is a category, which you can study. This is vague, but study geometrically. So this category doesn't come out of nowhere. So the point, I mean, where does this arise? The point is that if R happened to be commutative, then this Q-gur of R is an equivalent category to coherent sheaves on proj of R. And so again, lots of things I'm not defining here. I'm not going to say what coherent sheaves are. So this is just for the experts. But in the commutative case, doing this construction gives a category which is something familiar, coherent sheaves on a projective scheme. And in fact, this category of coherent sheaves, you can recover the scheme from it. So working with categories like this is in some sense equivalent to working with the schemes themselves.
Is the lowercase QQR identical to the uppercase?
No, that's just
QGR, sorry.
Okay, so working with these sort of things really does generalize working with commutative schemes in some sense. But this is something you can always define. And so you can try to do geometry with these categories instead of with spaces of points. Okay, so that's, I'm not going to say anything more about that. Except here, let's just say again what happens. The category you get in case one here is again just coherent sheaves on P2. But down here, what you get is not anything familiar. Okay, so for this example, the category QGR of R is some new category that's really not an analog of anything commutative.
How does it relate to coherent sheaves on the three lines?
I think the way you would think about that is the category of coherent sheaves on the three lines is a subcategory in there. So you can, the way you would think about this is these three lines sort of lie as subschemes of this category. But then there's all this other stuff.
That you can't study quite well.
That's right. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about that.
What about this glide-anon thing? Do you know what QGR is for any of that?
Again, for this glide-anon algebra, it's some interesting non-commutative geometric space, if you like. Cool. It's a category, but which again contains an elliptic curve in it in some sense. But
yeah, the group.
So in the commutative case, we can't quite reconstruct R, but we can come pretty close, right?
No, so what I meant in the commutative case is if you know coherent sheaves on some scheme, if you know that, you can recover X.
Yeah, but
not the ring.
Okay. I guess I wanted to understand.
So you need X and you need this category and you need to know which object is the structure sheet.
Okay.
Okay, then you can construct X.
Well, again, probably here up to stupid stuff you have in small degrees, it's nilpotent or something like that. I guess I was wondering what a corresponding statement would be non-commutatively, how well you can reconstruct your R.
That's a very interesting question about which there's an answer to that. But again, it's complicated. There are some rings R for which when you try to reconstruct it from the category, you get something bigger. But that doesn't happen for any of the examples I've written down. Okay, so I'd hope to have time, 5 minutes, to just state a few.
Okay, 5 minutes.
Okay, so this is actually something I did, which puts together some of the things I've defined. So this is work by myself and James Zhang. Okay, which, and the point of this is to show how all of these geometric constructions can really help you understand the rings themselves. So let R be some factoring of a free algebra, where now I'm going to assume it's strongly Noetherian, so I'm going to be able to talk about its point scheme. And I'll assume it's a domain. And one more thing, and I'm going to assume the function ring is a field. Okay, so that function ring is in general non-commutative, but there are examples like this one where it's actually a field. Okay. So those are the hypotheses. And what you can do then is let X be the point scheme of R that exists because it's strong in a theory. It exists as a projective scheme. Okay, then what happens is there's a ring homomorphism from R to something we're going to define using all this geometric stuff. Okay, so this will be some ring where I'm going to say what the homogeneous pieces are. So the nth homogeneous piece, okay, there's going to be a lot of unfamiliar notation here, sorry, which I'll try to describe in a sec. Okay, but basically what we're getting is this is the zeroth cohomology on the scheme X of some tensor product of these L's, L with the pullback by sigma of L all the way up to the pullback by sigma of M minus 1 of L, and a half sigma now R. So sigma is some automorphism of X, and L is some invertible sheaf on X. Okay, so again, I'm not gonna define those things exactly or define cohomology, but just think of this as a black box, if you'd like. It's some way of making a ring. This is a ring. There is a multiplication on here, which is non-commutative. It's a way of forming a non-commutative ring out of all this geometric stuff, scheme and automorphism, a line puzzle. Well, call it an invertible sheaf. X is not necessarily smooth. And what's the point? Which is an isomorphism in large degree. So not only is there a map from R to this ring defined by geometry, the rings are basically the same. There might be some funny business in low degrees, but in high degrees, they're isomorphic. So we think of them as basically the same. Okay, so under these hypotheses, all the rings you get can be completely described from geometric data, scheme, invertible sheaf, and automorphism. And you could say, for example, in one of these, so this case one is a ring which satisfies this theorem, case two doesn't. And in case one, you could say what all these things are. X is just P2. You could write down sigma, it just depends on these PIJs, and the line bundle you get is just O of 1. Okay, so that's where I'm just going to stop.
Questions, comments?
Yeah, can you say the last sentence again, please?
Yeah, so the only example I wrote down, I think, well, so commutative, all the commutative rings I discussed satisfy this theorem. But that was already known. I mean, that's nothing new. But this is the only other ring, the non-commutative ring I discussed, which is actually an example of the theorem. Because it is a strongly Noetherian ring, it turns out. This D is a field, so it has function ring, which is a field. It's a domain. So you can apply the theorem, and you could actually say what the X, sigma, and L are for this example. and I didn't write down, I'm not going to write down sigma, but X is P2, and L is the canonical invertible sheaf on P2 of degree 1 over 1.
The sigma is determined by these three.
Sigma is determined by the PIJs.
Yeah.
And it's simple, I just didn't work it out.
Is a field a skew field or a field?
No, no, when I say field, I really mean field. And I'll say division ring if I mean skew field.
Okay. But is it clear that nothing that...
Skew...
You're fine.
Yeah.
Is it clear that this can't be true for a skew field?
Yeah, I know.
Just because...
Yes, because, I mean, these rings...
The function field of X would be wrong. Yeah.
These rings always have commutative function ring.
I think the number theorems are about to be down.
Okay.
Yeah, 7 minutes.